Some weeks ago, I was invited to do an online survey by an international aid agency, and they followed that up this week by calling me to see about my preparedness in time of disaster. You know, what was I going to do? How was I going to respond to different kinds of situations? And it's a really good question to have. The local fire brigade will often invite us to, you know, make sure, have you got your fire plan ready, particularly as we go into the bushfire season. And as we know from the increasing reality of climate change, that those kinds of disasters seem to be unfolding around us more and more. So knowing, if you've only got a minute, what are the things you're going to reach for? What are those items that you're going to grab? What are those precious memories that you need to have, that you want to kind of cling to? In terms of our faith, it's an equally valid question about what are those essential parts of our faith that without those, you know, we are no longer to be able to be considered as Christians. And perhaps we've rediscovered the gift of the Eucharist as part of this, knowing that, you know, when we're deprived from that, there is this huge hole, this huge gap in our lives and in our experiences. In terms of the Jewish faith, you know, that sense of, well, out of all of the 613 mitzvah, of all of those different commandments that you find in the Torah, or from the book of Exodus through to the end of the book of Deuteronomy, which of those 365 prohibitions and 248 prescriptions, things that you shall do, out of all of those, which is the most significant? Which is the most important? And it was one of those questions that the rabbis would kind of judge and test each other on in terms of which ones were the ones that you were going to choose. So it was a valid question that this scribe comes to Jesus with. Out of all of those, what's the one thing you want to cling to, you want to hold on to in the midst of disaster, in the midst of trial? And so the first part of the answer that Jesus gives in saying there is one commandment, to then share the Shema, as the Jewish people called it, was not all that radical. It was, of course, part of the Jewish prayer and liturgy. Every morning upon rising, a good and devout Jewish person would take the words of the Shema upon their lips and pray it. Again, in the evening, when they were preparing for bed, they would again take the words of the Shema. Hear, O Israel, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Elohanu, Adonai Echad. The Lord, our God, the Lord is one. And therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your strength, and with all of your nefesh, your soul, your spirit. The ordering is slightly wrong there. With all of your heart, your strength, and your... I keep getting it wrong. Your heart and your soul and your strength, we would normally say. It's there, center of the section of Deuteronomy where Moses retells the story of the Sinai. Deuteronomy is a strange and interesting kind of book. In the 34 chapters that we have that form the work, in the narrative sense, apart from the introduction and the final paragraphs that conclude it, which talk of the death of Moses, all of the rest of the book is really live. It all happens just as Moses simply speaks this speech. It's this one single dialogue as he shares the story of God's people and retells those central laws and commandments that are part of the life and essence of the Jewish people. So the Shema finds its proper place there within that whole kind of retelling, or, you know, that re-expression. As they are about to go into the promised land, Moses wants to give them one final chance to get it wrong. They kept getting it wrong, but now he wants them to have this opportunity to get it right. So it was the part of the prayer and the life of the Jewish people. That sense of just praying with all that they were, praying with all that they could be, to offer themselves in that expression back to God. And so love is there at the heart of it. In fact, the book of Deuteronomy is the place where that word love, that the experience of love, is most commonly referred to. It's unusual, again, in that way. You know, Moses, we don't kind of think of as a very lovey-dovey kind of character. And yet when he's speaking of God, He delights to talk about the love with which the Father, with which God has first poured himself out upon us. And so the Jewish people are simply responding to this in this act of worship, in this act of declaring who they believe God to be. And so it is this creedal kind of statement. So Jesus retells that, restates that. Nothing controversial, nothing unusual in that. And yet, he then says, in answer to this question, which is the greatest? So one commandment, and what does Jesus say? Here is the first, and there's the second. So he just slips in the second one, and from the book of Leviticus chapter 19, and the second half of verse 18, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, if we started, you know, every week we pray the Apostles' Creed, and if we decided that, hey, how about we just add a couple of extra lines to the end of the Apostles' Creed? How do you think that would go down? Do you reckon the bishop would be kind of calling us and saying, Richard, just stick to the basic plan. Stick to the Apostles' Creed. Don't add anything extra to it. And yet this is precisely what Jesus is doing. He's taking the love of God as the first commandment and then saying, but this other commandment, this other reality also has to be there. And it makes perfect sense, again, within that Jewish understanding. The whole experience of love, and the word in Hebrew is ahava, is you can't love unless it's active, unless it's expressed in a verb. The only way that you can know that you are loving is if you put that love into action by being faithful and being caught up in that same steadfast love that God expressed to us. So how do we do that? And Jesus is right in adding that second commandment. The only way that we know that we love God is by loving our neighbor. And how do we love our neighbor when so often those neighbors don't seem to be very lovable, when we don't have that desire or that capacity to love? And I'm often reminded of that truth. You know, you can't give what you haven't got. So the first commandment is kind of that desire and that capacity to grow in love and to build that capacity for love. It's only to the extent that we receive that love of God that we're able then to share that love. Love your neighbor, ask yourself. You can't love your neighbor until you've spent time in prayer, sitting before God and allowing God to love us and to share that love and to pour that love into us so that we grow in our capacity and we begin to have, you know, greater abundance to be able then to share that love. That's where this Jesus Creed, as Scott McKnight calls it, is so crucial, so central to us. You know, if there is one kind of description that we can apply directly from the lips of Jesus about what does it mean to be a Christian, there's probably no better place to look than here in this 12th chapter of Mark's Gospel to understand that this is so central to our lives. To love God, yes, but we can only do that when we love our neighbor as ourselves. To follow in the example of the Jewish people by praying this in the morning, praying this in the evening, is a great practice and a great principle that we can apply and begin to live within our own lives. To understand, yes, to take the words of Jesus, to apply them and to adapt them within our own lives. So how about we indeed begin to do that? You know, each morning just to recite the words of Jesus as we hear them. Now, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And as for you, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all of who you are, and with everything that you have. And love your neighbor as yourself.